from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is shutdown fever in Washington. But across the country, the new health insurance offerings of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, roll out tomorrow. After years of debate and hand-wringing, tomorrow, October 1st, sign-up begins. Wherever you stand, it's historic. Is it right for you? This hour On Point, the rollout of Obamacare, we are here to take your questions. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Could this be for you, your family? Have you started to check it out? What's your question on the big new health insurance options? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Between our two guests today, I think we can help with the big picture and all the ins and outs. With us now from Washington, Sarah Cliff, Washington Post health policy reporter. She is deep in all the details of the health reform and what it offers. Sarah, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Jonathan Cohn joins us, senior editor at The New Republic, author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan, welcome. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. So we know there is a lot of drama out there. We're not going to ignore that. I'm sure we'll be talking about it plenty this week. But there's also a very historic piece of legislation that, as we speak, is headed into effect tomorrow. Sarah, help us just begin to wade in here. Just start with the first question. Who is eligible to participate in this new health care coverage?
Sure. And it's actually a relatively small segment of the population. If you have insurance right now through your employer or through Medicare or Medicaid, two federal programs, okay, you're really not going to see much of a change. And you're actually, if you are getting coverage right now, you are not eligible to buy coverage on these new marketplaces. The people we're talking about who this affects fall into two categories. One, they're uninsured. There are about 48 million Americans who currently lack insurance, or they buy their own insurance coverage right now on the individual market. Mm-hmm. And these are the two groups that are really most affected by what's happening tomorrow.
Does that mean that this is heavily tilted toward low-income American families?
Yes, definitely. And I think that was, and you know, Jonathan can definitely speak to it, but that was the intention of this law, was to give assistance to people who have traditionally not been able to afford insurance, who have been shut out of the market because they have a pre-existing condition. The whole idea was to bring lower income people into the insurance system.
Jonathan, what exactly happens tomorrow, October 1st?
So tomorrow in every state, there will be a new insurance market available. And if you know, in the there will be a world in which if you have a pre-existing condition and previously you were not able to buy health insurance because of that pre-existing condition, you know, an insurance company would not sell it to you. Mm-hmm. Or you had no source of insurance from an employer and you could maybe get an insurance company to sell you coverage, but you couldn't afford it because it was too expensive. Well, starting tomorrow in every state, there will be an opportunity to start buying insurance that is priced like normal insurance, like the insurance that employers now provide to their employees. It'll be available to everybody, regardless of pre-existing condition, at uniform prices. It will have a kind of set of, you know, set benefits, and there will be tax credits available for people who can't afford it on their own. Now, the catch is, when I say that this insurance is available, it doesn't actually start until January 1st, even if you buy it right away. And of course, whether you can actually buy it tomorrow, going on a website to buy it, going through some intermediary, well, that's somewhat in question and also going to vary a lot by state. There are technological issues. Some states already have announced that you'll have to wait a little bit. So the market officially opens tomorrow, but whether people can actually go buy the insurance tomorrow is a more complicated question.
Sarah, it's federal law, but we've clearly seen the different kinds of receptions politically in different states. Are all states participating, Sarah?
Yes, so that's an easy question to answer. With the marketplaces, there will be a marketplace in every state and the District of Columbia. Most of them are run by the federal government, and that goes back to what you were saying about a lot of the political opposition. The federal government and the law gave states the opportunity to decide whether they wanted to build this marketplace or leave the task to the federal government. When the law passed over 3 years ago, there was more of an expectation here in Washington that all states would want to run their marketplaces. Why would they give this thing to the federal government when they could do it themselves? What we saw play out, in fact, was most states didn't want to. There's a lot of opposition. and largely Republican states said, we're not going to help you out on this. This is your law. We oppose it. You guys can build these marketplaces that you support. So what you see is in mostly Democrat-governed states, there are state-based marketplaces. There's 16 states in the District of Columbia running their own marketplaces. The rest of them are being run either completely or in partnership with the federal government.
So what's the typical doorway into this? Is it a website? Is it an office? Here I am. You know, I'm 32 years old. I've got two kids. I don't have insurance. I'm interested. What do I do?
So there's a few different doorways. One is a website, and those will go live tomorrow. And there's a website called healthcare.gov that'll guide you to the marketplace in your state. So that's one portal. Another is this group of workers called navigators, who there are thousands of them currently being trained, who are basically going to be out and about in communities to answer questions. They might be in a hospital, or they might be at a local nonprofit. So that's one group of outreach workers. The federal government has also paid for every community health center, every federally qualified community health center in the country. And there are thousands of them across the country. They will all have a navigator. The idea being there that federally qualified health centers see a lot of uninsured people so that they could get people as they're coming into the doctor. Libraries have also volunteered to play a role, that you can go into your local library and learn more about the healthcare law. A number of drugstores are doing programs to get people signed up. So it might actually be, you know, in certain areas with really high rates of uninsurance, mm-hmm. It might be hard to walk around at some point in the next few months without someone trying to mention this law to you.
Jonathan, if I'm in America, and without health insurance coverage, is it a slam dunk that I'm going to want to sign up for this?
No, I don't think it is. I think, and this is one of the
Why
issues
not?
That, well, I mean, first of all, there are people who don't have health insurance right now. And I think if you look today at the population that does not have health insurance, you would find a pretty wide variety of people. There are people who would love to get health insurance, who are desperate to get health insurance, but can't because they can't afford it. They have a pre-existing condition.
So they'll want to. I mean,
they'll want. Well, you know, this is complicated. On the other end of the spectrum, right, you have people, you know, maybe they're young, they're healthy. They figure, why do I need health insurance? Why do I want to pay for it? And then you have a lot of people in the middle who they want health insurance. They appreciate the protection that health insurance provides for them. But, you know, it's expensive, and they have other expenses, obviously, and they are trying to make a decision. Is this worth it? So you have that whole spectrum of people, and now they are going to go, and they're going to look at what's available to them. And, of course, the way the law is structured with the different levels of subsidies and tax credits available to people, there'll be different prices available, different products available. You know, you'll be able to buy a more generous insurance policy or a less generous insurance policy. Obviously, the more generous, the more protection it gives you, the more it's going to cost. And, you know, different people are going to have different reactions. Some people will look at this and say, wow, this is a great deal. I like this. I am dying to get this. You know, some people are going to look at it and say, really? I was expecting more. This seems like a lot of money. And they may not. But of course, if they choose not to buy it and it's available to them at an affordable rate, then they do face this financial penalty. That's the individual mandate that's been so controversial. So that has to factor into the equation as well.
Sarah, presumably some number of uninsured people, they've known in the back of their minds, if I get really sick, I can show up at an emergency room and they will treat me. So why do this?
Because the emergency room is expensive. That it is a way to get health care. And
if
you're
I'm
right,
broke,
there are people.
Or
if you're broke, yeah. I mean, it's a decision you're going to see a lot of people weighing through. That a lot of people would like the security of being able to go to the doctor, mm-hmm. of not kind sure. of having this drag on their minds of what am I going to do if I get really sick. And you are right. The emergency room is federally required to accept everyone. But I think there are some people who would like to have the security of being able to go to the doctor on a regular basis and be able to see someone to address some less urgent needs. But I think you will hear that argument, and you are hearing that argument around Washington right now, that, you know, from some of, there are some campaigns right now that are starting saying, you don't need to buy this insurance. You can just go to the emergency room when you get sick, pay the individual mandate fine, it'll be a better deal for you. And I think that's going to be a fight we're going to be having, you know, surrounding Obamacare's launch in its first year.
But Jonathan, I mean, you've written again and again, before this was passed, we've had a health care system that was becoming more and more unmanageably expensive and leaving more and more people out. Does this look like the scoop that's going to bring people in at a reasonable cost and get them covered?
I'm optimistic, and like anything, we can't know for sure, but I'm optimistic. I think two things to keep in mind. On the emergency room question, it's certainly true. If you show up at an emergency room and you are bleeding to death or you have a heart attack, they'll treat you. They have to. As Sarah says, there's a federal law about that. But the fact is that you will get the immediate treatment. You may not get the follow-up treatment. Yep. You're not getting the preventative routine care. And by the way, they're going to bill you. So, there's a lot of stories out there. Hospitals, when you go to the emergency room and you run up $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 in bills, they will go after you for those bills and they'll send collection agencies. And if you have nothing, well, then I guess you have nothing to lose. But if you have a little income, this is going to be a problem. On the flip side, there are going to be people who look at this just as there are today and say, look, I'll just take my chances. I'm going to roll the dice. In terms of the success of the program, though, it's important to remember for Obamacare, if we're going to call it that, if it's going to succeed, it's not important that everybody sign up, particularly in the early going. From a sort of making the numbers work standpoint, you simply need a minimum a sort of threshold of young and healthy people enough to balance off the cost to make the system work.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rollout of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Sign up starts tomorrow, October 1st. All the shutdown talk notwithstanding, it's on. And if you want to get in, we're here for your questions. Sarah Cliff is with us from the Washington Post, health policy reporter there, joins us from Washington. Jonathan Cohn as well in Washington, senior editor at the New Republic. Sarah, can you begin to lay out what this costs?
It's actually a pretty complex question.
Yep.
And, I'd probably take up the rest of our radio show if I was trying to run through what it means for everyone. In general, you see a lot of variation based on a couple of factors. One is how old you are. The Affordable Care Act allows insurance companies to charge older people three times as much as young people. So that's one thing that's going to matter. If you're 25 and if you're 60, you're going to face different premiums. Another factor is where you live. Insurance is generally a state-based market, and insurers file rates for each state. So you see variation in Alaska, for example. It's very, very expensive to deliver health care, so you see higher rates there. And there's really a wide variety across the country. And the last thing I would add that's important are these tax subsidies, where the federal government is going to give low- to middle-income people a help with their premiums. And depending on what you earn, you can go on – if you go to the Kaiser Family Foundation's website, kff.org, you can actually type in your information and see what kind of subsidy you would qualify for, that some people will be getting help buying insurance from the federal government. So there's factors of geography, age, and income. Those are really important in determining how much this will cost.
But give us some examples here. People hear numbers flying around, insurance for as little as $90 a month, or it may cost you hundreds a month. What's the range? Give us some dimensions.
Sure. There is a big range. So what I will say is that Health and Human Services, in a report they put out last week, they said the average monthly premium for a middle-of-the-road plan, this is a silver plan in the terminology of the exchanges, but basically kind of a not the most robust, but a pretty middle-of-the-road plan, the average premium for that would be about $330 per month. And that is before a subsidy from the federal government. Now, they've also said
$334. How old is this person?
This is an average across ages.
Oh, everybody.
It's taking into account, people are older, younger.
Yep.
So, again, I would caution from reading too much into that because there is so much variation. One other data point I would put out there is Health and Human Services has also said that 6 in 10 of the people who are currently uninsured will be able to find a premium for less than $100 a month on the marketplace. Now, this might not be the top-tier plan. This might be a little bit more of a more bare-bones plan, but it will be an insurance plan that will be available for less than $100 a month. And the federal government estimates about 6 in 10 of the people who are uninsured right now will have that option.
We'll look at what that might cover. Jonathan, I'm looking here at examples given, for example, in Texas here. After factoring in the subsidies, those tax subsidies that Sarah talks about, an average 27-year-old with an income of $25,000 would pay, this is in Texas, $145 a month for the benchmark second lowest cost silver plan. We'll look at that. 133 for the lowest, 83 for the very lowest bronze plan. Family of four in Texas with an income of $50,000 would pay between $282 for the highest coverage of those and $57 at the low for the same plans. How do you gauge affordability here, Jonathan? I know there's a wide range, but is there, just to broadly describe it, is this affordable for the population it's intended for?
Sure. Well, it's really the best question you can ask, and actually one we don't ask a lot in this debate, I feel like. And I think the first thing you have to say is that affordability is a subjective judgment. Some people, what I think is affordable may not be what someone else thinks is affordable.
Well, subjective, so, until it's food, rent, and health,
right,
insurance.
Right. So I will say there was a study, and it's actually the only one I can recall seeing like this. It was co-authored by Jonathan Gruber. People who follow the health policy debate will recognize him. He's an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. He's sort of one of the best known experts on this. He's done a lot of the modeling about how these plans work. He was behind the Massachusetts experience. He is an advocate. He is a believer in these plans, but he's a very well-respected economist. He actually did a study, he co-authored, I can't remember the co-author's name, in which they actually came up with a formula for affordability. And they said, all right, well, how much do we reasonably expect a family to have to pay for food, for housing, for clothing, for gas in the car, the routine expenses of life? And then let's map that onto the new healthcare plan. And it was a very interesting finding. It suggested that the vast majority of people in America would, in fact, find affordable policies under the new healthcare law. That, in fact, because the law was structured this way. Remember, the less money you make, the more federal assistance you get. The cheaper the insurance becomes. Even if you have less money, not only do you get assistance paying your premiums, you also get assistance paying those out of pocket costs. You know, when you go to the doctor, mm-hmm. the copay on your prescription. Now, it didn't say that everybody would find it affordable. There were people in particular. There was a kind of spot in the sort of, there were a couple patches where people with very high medical expenses really were still going to struggle. The flip side is these were people who struggle now. So this wasn't something the law was making worse. It was something the law wasn't fully making better. But, if you go by that, and like I said, it's the best study I've seen on this, that tells me most people can afford this. Now, that doesn't mean they can afford it easily. They may have to sort of tuck here and there.
Yeah, yeah.
But most people, I think, can afford this.
I want to dig on into those issues of coverage, but we have a lot of people calling in to talk with the two of you. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, and Bruce. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to comment that a lot of what I'm hearing on the radio is addressing low income. And I think that for my family, we're sort of on that precipice of income of about $50,000 a year, plus
okay.
a few benefits, company car, and et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
And my wife and I took a high deductible, $5,000 deductible years ago at about $240 a month.
Okay.
But as we aged, I'm now 60, and my wife is shortly behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Our premiums went up to over $650, and we dropped it about a year ago.
So you're uncovered now.
Yes, I'm uncovered.
Wow, scary at that age.
Decided,
yeah.
We've never gone over that $5,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
So. But I think that as a country, I've been typically Republican, but I voted for Obama, President Obama, because I was excited about a president that would take action, not just talk about reforming health care. So I think we need to give it a try. And I would also like to, instead of hearing it called Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
let's call it what it is. It's the Affordable Health Care Act.
Yeah, we've kind of got both going in this culture at the moment. We certainly have both going right here. But Bruce, hang on with me for a second. Sarah, you hear Bruce's story very broadly. Does this sound like an American family that would be wise to look at this program? Is it likely to be more affordable than what he has found, which became too much for him and his wife, and they dropped?
I think so. I'd caution against making any sort of predictions for an individual and don't want to give any
mm-hmm.
specific consumer advice here. But it sounds like for someone who doesn't have coverage right now, who's found coverage too expensive in the individual market, these are the types of situations that the healthcare law is meant to address. And even there might be some people in a similar situation who can get health insurance right now or may have a pre-existing condition, so they're shut out of the market. So this definitely sounds like one of the situations. Again, as Jonathan was saying, it's going to be, you know, a lot of your own calculations about what is affordable, what can I spend on this. But these are the types of situations exactly that the Affordable Care Act is trying to address.
Household of two, income of about $50,000, right near the national median. Is he likely to have a subsidy from the federal government for his insurance, Sarah?
You know, I'm trying to look that up right now because I don't want to give any incorrect information. But yes, I think so. So to help you out a little bit, the subsidies go up to four times the federal poverty line,
which is 20 something.
Which is actually it's for one person, it's $11,490.
Yeah.
For two people, it's $15,000. $15,000. So we're looking at, if you multiply that times four, we're looking at about $60,000 is where the subsidies go up to. So that would suggest that a family of two making $50,000 would qualify for some subsidies through this program.
Bruce, I appreciate your call, and I wish you good luck with it. I hope you find something to cover you and your wife there. One more right here from South Carolina. Don, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My situation is I'm buying health insurance through my employer, but they no longer pay very much of it. It used to be different, you know, 10 years ago, but now I'm paying about 75% by my rough calculation.
Yeah, so most of it's on you.
Mm-hmm. Right, and income's just over $20,000, you know, in the low 20s.
Okay.
And I think it would be very advantageous for me to buy it on the exchange, but I don't know from some of the comments whether people like me can buy it on the exchange.
Because you've got some employer coverage.
Because we've got it.
Even if they're not chipping in much. Hey, Don, let us raise that. That's a very good question. Jonathan, Sarah, I'll come to you. Jonathan, do you know? I mean, here, Don has got some coverage, but his employer doesn't chip in a lot on it anymore. So what about him?
It's an excellent question, and I'm going to start with the exact same disclaimer that Sarah did, which is that I don't want to be offering specific consumer advice just because it is so hard in these situations.
This is beyond specific, though.
No, I understand. I just want to be clear that I, you know, in terms of Don's specific situation without seeing the specifics. In general, if you have, the way this is going to work is that if you have, the law is designed to help people who do not have affordable coverage available from an employer.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, that's going to mean people who don't have an employer that offers insurance or they don't have a job, whatever. There are some people, however, you know, who are going to work for an employer and there will be insurance available, but it is so expensive that it is, the law deems it unaffordable. Now, the threshold for that, as I recall, is about 10% of your income. So that if the premiums that you're paying are more than 10% of your income, then you suddenly become eligible to go into the exchanges. So the question is for Don would be, well, it's not so much how much of the insurance is he paying, but that premium he's paying, how much of his income does that represent?
Right.
So, and that would be the question.
Sarah, does it sound like he might be then eligible for this? As Jonathan says, he should check it out.
Yeah, I think so. Jonathan is exactly right. This threshold that the federal government has set for affordability, they say if you have to spend more than 9.5% of your income on your premiums, then you don't have to take that insurance policy. You can go onto the marketplaces. If you are someone who's earning about $20,000 a year, you would certainly qualify for tax credits to help purchase your insurance. So it does sound like this could be an option for someone in a situation like this one.
Sarah, can we look at the levels of coverage, this bronze and silver and gold and platinum? I'm reading here that if you get the bronze, that's the lowest level. It would cover 60% of covered medical expenses. Silver, 70%. Gold, 80%. Platinum, 90%. But is there a cap on this? I mean, you can get up into the tens of thousands really quickly. Is there some cap on what your exposure is?
There is a cap for lower income people. There is an out-of-pocket cap if you're someone
who
is getting... You know what? I don't actually know the exact number offhand, but I know that there is a limit, and maybe Jonathan might know this and be able to.
I mean, is it tens of thousands of dollars? Is it $5,000?
I believe it's more in the $5,000 range, but this is one thing I would need to double check before giving anyone specifics. But
I mean,
maybe,
that's pretty important. If you're only covered for 60%, you better darn well know how.
Well, and let me add one thing to that. So the way these different metal levels that you ran through, you know, ranging from bronze to platinum work, is it's not necessarily it'll cover 60% of your cost, that if you, let's say, go to the doctor, they cover 60% and you're stuck with 40. The way these work, they're known as actuarial values in insurance speak, and they cover 60% of the average person's costs. Now, let's say you're someone who's 23, you're pretty young, you don't go to the doctor a lot. You might be attracted to one of these bronze plans because you figure preventive care is free, so that'll be covered. It has a lower premium. And if you're not someone who plans to use a lot of medical services, a bronze plan might be the best fit. It's not going to be as expensive as a platinum plan, for example, which would have much higher premiums.
But there's where the cap makes such a difference. Sure. I'm 23. I can get in a car accident like anybody else. I could run up tens of thousands of dollars in bills. I thought that there was a $6,000 sort of cap on what I would be hit with, even if I was only covered 60%.
Yes, and there is a cap. I just, I would have to look up the exact number on it before putting that out there on the radio. One thing I would add is also the Affordable Care Act. One thing it has already done is ended lifetime limits on benefits. This is one thing that most of us don't bump into, but a lot of insurance plans might have a lifetime or annual limit of, you know, $100,000 or something like that. So that is one thing all of these plans will have in common, is there's no limit to the coverage. So if you do end up in a very expensive healthcare situation, there's not a point where your coverage just stops and you're on your own.
I'm being told here something like $6,350 cap for an individual, $12,700 for a family. I can't completely confirm those, and look where you are around the country. Look at the different levels of coverage. But, Jonathan, I'm seeing something like that. I mean, this is the first question people are going to ask.
Sure.
What's my exposure under this insurance? It's fundamental.
Right. No, I think, Sarah, I mean, you want to be careful, you know, sort of saying that. But I think my understanding, I'm pretty sure this is right, is that the numbers you just cited are correct, that that is the maximum out-of-pocket you would face for an individual. And I think it's doubled, about $12,000-something for a family policy.
Right.
And now the key things to remember are, as Sarah said, first of all, that there are, in addition to that, there are all sorts of other protections and limits put into the law. So there's no more annual caps on benefits. There's no more lifetime limits. There are guarantees that insurance policies must cover essential health benefits. And that's really important. People, you know, don't fully appreciate that, I think. You know, today, if you go to buy an insurance policy, if you go to e-health insurance, you know, on the web, or you go through a broker, these individual policies, they may sound really good when you buy them.
Oh, this is a great price. I'm covered, right.
Yeah, right. And then, you know, it discovered, oh, wait, it doesn't really have prescription coverage. It doesn't have maternity benefits, that kind of thing. So these policies all have to cover those. The other thing is, again, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, is that if you're lower income, there's extra subsidies to offset those out-of-pocket costs. So if you're making $20,000 a year, you're not going to face $6,000 in out-of-pocket costs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rollout of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Sign up starts tomorrow, October 1st. All the shutdown drama notwithstanding, it's on, and if you want to get in or are thinking about it, we are here for your questions with Sarah Cliff from The Washington Post, Jonathan Cohn from The New Republic, and lots of listeners on the line. Kathy in Cranston, Rhode Island. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah.
I would like to say that I am absolutely for this new Affordable Care Act. I'm a single person trying to survive by myself and pay all my bills, and I work for a small company, and they do offer insurance. I'm paying $3,000 a year for my insurance.
Okay.
And I understand by doing the calculations that I will be able to be subsidized for this coverage when I go into this new plan.
So far, it looks like a good deal to you. Are you confident enough to pull the trigger, say I'm signing up, or are you going to sit down with some kind of counselor on this? Kathy, what's your plan?
I'm going to talk to someone, yes, about the different levels. But
right.
My company has already issued a letter to each of us
right.
announcing that it is unaffordable insurance. They have been deemed unaffordable.
You mean, the coverage that they provide you now?
Company I work for has been deemed unaffordable by its by the government, apparently.
Do you feel like they're trying to hustle you? Are they trying to hustle you over onto this new plan? Is that what they're up to?
No, they're going to continue to carry their plan, and they're going to continue to, donate their share to it. But I won't be able to get that share
right.
under this Affordable Care Act.
Right, got it. Kathy, thanks for your call. I appreciate it very much. Sarah, here's another Sarah. Beth writes to us, a New South girl on Twitter, says, self-insured and just found out my premiums are going up by $120 a month. Supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but this seems less affordable. She's self-insured but worried it's going to cost her more under the Affordable Care Act. Does that make sense to you, Sarah?
There will certainly be situations where people will pay more. I think, I would caution against drawing any wide conclusions about what this means for premiums. But for some people, one of the things the healthcare law does, as Jonathan mentioned, is it does require coverage of a number of benefits that sometimes have not been covered in the individual market. When you increase the coverage of benefits, one of the ways to do that is you have to pay for those benefits. Some people in those situations might see the base premium go up, but also be getting a tax credit that'll cover some of that increase.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a case-by-case situation, but I think we will hear about those situations where some people are finding that they cannot find options that cost what they cost before the Affordable Care Act.
All kinds of reaction here. Matt says, excited to sign up tomorrow. May seem corny, but it's good to know my society cares enough about me not to let me die in the street or go bankrupt if I get sick. Thanks, America, he writes. Not everybody's so keen on it, but here's Jacob, says, I'm a single dad, full-time student, part-time employee in two places. Before the act, I had no coverage. Now I'll be able to get a policy, he thinks, for about $50 a month, maybe after subsidies, I don't know. Now both my daughter and I will have health care. Check out all the details, Jacob. Steve in Massillon, Ohio. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, what do you think, Steve?
I understand the need for affordable health care for everybody, but you know what? I'm a taxpayer, and I've been paying in taxes for 50 years, and I got a letter from my company here the other day telling me that because of the affordable health care plan, I have to pay a tax starting the first of the year on my current medical plan.
Yep.
So not only am I paying $40 or $50 a month for my current medical plan, which is proposed that it's going to go up.
Yep.
I have to pay a $46 a month tax. I'm already paying Medicare and Social Security. It's like, now I'm getting taxed again.
And you're not getting more benefits for that. That just goes into the pot so that other people can get covered, I guess.
Yeah.
Steve, hang on. I get that you don't like that, and that can be a hit to a family budget. That obviously, Sarah, does that sound right to you? We've got taxes now on those who are covered, taxes on their company-provided medical coverage.
I'm not familiar with exactly the tax that's being discussed here. I don't know what exactly provision that might be. There is some concern. I mean, there is a fee that insurance companies are going to be paying. It's called a reinsurance fee that they are going to be paying to essentially help out the individual market a little bit. And that's one area where insurance companies have been vocal in trying to change that. They have not been able to change that. And there's a question of whether employers are going to absorb some of those costs or if they'll get passed on to the consumer. And this might be one situation where you're seeing an employer passing on these costs of the Affordable Care Act to consumers.
Jonathan, you see Steve's complaint here. Look, it's just going to cost me more. I don't get more. And he already pays plenty, he feels, for Medicare, for Social Security, and here comes yet another tax.
Right. So now I just want to double check something. Steve, I don't know if he's still on the line.
Yes, he is.
Steve, was this a policy that you were buying on your own or through an employer?
Through an employer.
It's through your employer. And you said it was $50 a month extra from a tax?
Nearly.
It's a tax to provide. Obama wants to put a tax money through to get, 2.2 $1 million in a tax pool.
Okay.
To help pay for the Affordable Care Act.
Got it. And your $40, $50 that you say you're paying a month, that's your share of what you pay, right?
That's
your employee share?
The company pays for the balance, and I pay $46 a month or something like that.
Right.
Or my copay.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So now I understand. Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure I understood the details.
Yep.
So I would say I'm a bit surprised to hear that a company would say that the sort of the tax, there is this tax which Sarah described, which insurers are paying. That is part of a deal that was basically when this bill was written, it was very important to me that it was going to be fiscally responsible. We weren't going to spend more money than taking in. And part of the deal was every member of the healthcare industry was asked to come to the table and say, look, you know, pony up a little bit. You know, we are all making a lot of money here. You can all afford to make do with a little less revenue.
But this is falling on Steve, who may not be making a lot of money.
Right. I'm getting to that. Yes.
Yep.
So, and this tax was part of it. That tax alone is a very small amount of money. That should not be why you're paying 40 or 50 extra a month. Again, I can't, you know, I don't know what's going on with your company, so it's hard to know exactly what else might be going on there. I will say in general that when it comes to people who have policies from their employers, not much should be changing. If you have a medium to large employer, the law does not change very much. This is by design. The idea was that people who have insurance and like it should, you know, we're not going to try to, the architects of the law did not want to really mess with that. So fluctuate, you know, premiums should not be going up by that much because of the law. You know, one thing to remember, everybody needs to remember, is that insurance was changing already long before the law came along. Insurance premiums went up every year before the law came along. There may be companies who are saying, hey, we're raising your premiums this year and Obamacare is the reason. That doesn't necessarily mean Obamacare is the reason. You know, there, you know, the stories we've heard about companies squeezing their retirement plans, things like that. A lot of these are changes that companies were in the process of making already.
But you guys are saying there's no general tax on health insurance benefits that employed people get now from their employers that's part of funding Obamacare. Are you sure about that?
Oh, I'm saying there is, but I'm saying it's very small. The fee that Sarah was talking about is a very small fee. That would not explain a $40 to $50 increase in, I don't think, you know, on its own would not explain a $40 to $50 monthly increase, I would not think.
Steve, I don't know if we've got you completely covered on your question there, but I hope that's a beginning on it, and I appreciate your call. I want to go to Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Rachel. Rachel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My family, we're a family of four, and we make about $23,000 a year. And I use that calculator to see what we're looking at for tomorrow in the marketplace. And it, because we're at 98% of the poverty level and not 100%, we are not going to get any federal assistance at all. And up to this point, we haven't been insured. And so if we need to go to the hospital or what have you, we will, they have programs where you can, you know, send them your tax information, et cetera, and they will cut off a percentage because of your position, and we'll pay for it that way.
Right.
But now we are going to have to pay something every month, and it's going to cost more no matter what. So now we have to decide what's cheaper. Is to pay for a bronze plan, which is still going to essentially cost the same amount, if not more, than we've already been taken care of in some situations, and or the penalty, you know, which is cheaper.
Yeah, this is this strange thing that's developed, Sarah, where people in real poverty, and Sarah's just under that line, so she's in it. I mean, our caller Rachel, I should say, are often not covered. What's going on with that, Rachel? Sarah, excuse me.
Yeah,
all these Old Testament names, I'm getting lost here.
This is kind of fallout from the Supreme Court decision on the healthcare law, which told states that they did not have to participate in the Medicaid expansion. And while we talk a lot about private insurance and the role that plays, Medicaid is a really crucial element of the insurance expansion. As the law was written, it was supposed to cover everyone up to 133% of the poverty line, which is about $15,000 for an individual.
Right.
What happened with the Supreme Court decision is the justices said that's too coercive. Each state gets to decide. Oklahoma, for example, is one state that has decided not to expand Medicaid. And that means if you are someone who is below the poverty line, you kind of fall into this no man's land where you don't make enough to get subsidies. The subsidies were supposed to cover people who earn a little bit more. And the assumption when legislators wrote this law was that Medicaid would cover people in Rachel's situation. And now you see, you know, about half the states have decided not to expand Medicaid so far. And that really leaves families like Rachel, you know, I understand that's a difficult situation to be in. One thing I would add is, you know, in terms of thinking about, well, what should I do? There are exemptions for people who can't afford insurance from the individual mandate. If insurance costs more than 8% of your family income, then you're not going to be fined for not carrying insurance. So that's one thing to consider, is that because there is this hardship exemption, you might not face a penalty.
Jonathan Cohen, it's very confusing, I think, to a lot of people that after all the smoke and fury here, this thing is settled and the most impoverished Americans aren't covered.
It's confusing, and I think to the advocates of the law, it's incredibly frustrating, particularly because the states where this is happening, for the most part, are states with the largest numbers of uninsured people. We are talking about places not just like Oklahoma, but Texas and Florida, with millions of people who the architects of the law designed this so that these low-income people, like your caller, would be eligible for Medicaid. That was the plan. And then the Supreme Court stepped in and basically changed the equation in such a way that made it very easy for officials in these states to reject the Medicaid expansion. And so somebody living in Texas or Florida or Oklahoma now is stuck and cannot get health insurance. You know, I would sort of say three quick things. Number one, it's been very interesting to me, a number of Republican governors in Michigan, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in Arizona have all come out and said, you know, we think this is good for our state, even though we're Republicans, and even though we don't really like this law. We think this part, as state officials, we'd be nuts to turn this down. We have so many people who could benefit from this. It's basically free money for the states. So they have changed. And even the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, of all people, has actually said this. So there is some interest in this. Number two, to echo what Sarah said, no one's going to your caller, she does not need to worry about paying that penalty. That does not apply. There was a rule on this. If you are in one of these states where there's no Medicaid available and you're below the poverty line, no one's going to penalize you, certainly. I mean, the problem is you're not getting in health insurance and you need it. But, you know, I think that's a reminder to people who live in these states, as well as, you know, the people who work in these states in the healthcare industry, there is a way to change this. You can go to your state officials. People who don't like the situation should talk to their state legislatures, should talk to their governors, should talk to the representatives, say, hey, why are you turning down this Medicaid expansion? Why can't we have the same benefits that a low-income person in California or Maryland or Illinois has?
This conversation at that level, clearly not over. Rachel, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. One more call. Stan in Southwick, Massachusetts. Stan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love your show and a great topic today. I'll be brief. What I'm finding listening to everybody today, there's definitely more questions than answers, and I think that's the huge problem with this plan. The president, the Democrats, should have come out with a lot more education for the public. But my main point is, I think this plan is going to implode on itself. The reason being, it's all based on young people enrolling. You see former President Clinton trying to get the young people out. I think that is the downfall, and my prediction is this plan will fail for that one reason.
Because you don't think young Americans are going to sign up, what they'll pay the individual mandate penalty and just do without?
Absolutely. Young people, you know what, we were all young. We're invincible. Health is one of the last things you worry about, and that is the cornerstone, the foundation of this plan, and that is why I can't believe more people aren't talking about it, because I think that is going to come crumbling down on itself for that one reason.
Let us pick it up right here. Sarah, we've just got a minute or so, but what about that? What percentage of America's youth does this plan need to sign up, and does it look likely?
So, I mean, I would echo the point. That's exactly right, that young people do need to enroll for this to work. And the way the White House thinks about this when I've talked to them is forecasters say 7 million people will buy insurance on these new marketplaces we've been talking about.
Young
next
people
year.
Or total?
Total. Okay. So the White House thinks to hit the ratio right, they need 2.7 million of those people to be younger people. So they're thinking, you know, it's less for them when I talk to them, it's less about the number of people they sign up, but it's a getting that ratio right, getting enough young people into the pool so that premiums don't skyrocket. And I think there's going to be such a focus on reaching young people. Just today, this humor website, Funny or Die, was putting out a parody of the show Scandal that's basically trying to reach young people and let them know about the Affordable Care Act.
You think it's going to make sense to a 27-year-old? They're going to look at this and say, well, I'm not making a ton, but yeah, I want that.
Actually, most surveys show that most young people do consider insurance important. It's affordability that tends to be the barrier. I think the really big thing will be seeing what premiums cost and deciding, you know, is that something that fits in my budget?
Well, a lot of people are going to be opening up, whether through the federal portal or their own state's online portal, are going to be opening up this whole world tomorrow and checking out the options to see what's available to them. All their decisions put together, yes, our caller's exactly right, are going to have a lot to say about where this goes. We're not going to drop it. It's clearly a political hot potato, but it's also important to people's lives. We will keep touching back to see how it's going as it rolls out. Sarah Cliff with The Washington Post, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Cohn of The New Republic, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, too.
Listeners, we'll stick with you. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.